talked about the fact that the universe is actually inhomogeneous and anisotropic
because it's full of lots of structure like galaxies and stars. And understanding those inhomogeneities and isotropies is a lot of what current research in cosmology is about. And the way we parameterize those, at least when the perturbations are small, is by the departure in the density, the mass density or the energy density, the fluctuations, these are called the density perturbations, which is the difference between the actual density at some point in space and time and the mean density that you use in the Friedman equation. So rho bar is just defined by the average taken over all space of the actual density. So those denote the fluctuations away from the mean. And in fact, that more often we use this thing, which is the fractional energy density perturbation. So this is a dimensionless quantity. And if this quantity delta is greater than zero, then it means locally that region is overdense relative to the mean. So locally the density is higher. And because of gravitational instability, what in just flat space time is called a Jeans instability, but you know, also exists in expanding space time. Whenever you have a region which is slightly overdense, that overdensity will grow in time because of gravitational collapse. And that's what we discussed last time. And the equation, if the fluctuations are small, which is the same saying that delta is much less than one, then they satisfy some linear equation like this that we derive this time. So this is the double rate of change in time for the density perturbations. This piece and this piece look like a wave equation with the speed of sound CS. This is a damping term, which is called the Hubble damping, and comes from the effect of the fact that because space is expanding, this damps how quickly the the instability grows in time. And this part comes from just the direct interaction of gravity. This is the thing. Because of this minus here, this is unstable. That drives the instability and the gravity. What happens is that short wavelength perturbations, modes whose wavelength is less than the characteristic scale, the Jeans length, are actually stable because the pressure wins over gravity. So gravity isn't strong enough to defeat the pressure term. So this is the pressure term here. That comes from the fact that the gas has pressure, and so some non-zero speed of sound. And this is the gravity term. When the pressure wins, the density perturbations just behave like waves. This is just one wave, but of course you have a superposition of those in general. And there's no instability here. They just oscillate, but the amplitude of those waves doesn't change in time. But long wavelength perturbations, which have wavelengths bigger than the Jeans length, they're unstable, so they grow in time. In general, if you solve this equation for long wavelengths, then you'll get two modes. One you call the growing mode because it grows in time. There's t to the 2/3 in a matter-dominated era, and one which decays away and so is largely irrelevant for most of the time. And so this is the actual growth in a matter era, at least. This is how fluctuations grow. And so if you start out with a small fluctuation, eventually, if you give it enough time, you'll get to a point where delta hits 1. And that's essentially then when this linear equation is no longer valid, the whole thing becomes nonlinear and gravitational collapse fully sets in, and that's, from then on, is essentially when galaxies form. Describing that whole process is very complicated, but roughly speaking, you can say whenever delta hits 1, you form a galaxy. It's a very simplistic way of describing it, but it's pretty much true. Okay, and so the cosmic microwave background is also not perfectly isotropic. There's no point saying homogeneous here because when you're looking at the cosmic microwave background, you're just looking out in different directions. So all you can tell is whether or not it's anisotropic or not, but you can't tell if it's homogeneous because it all comes from a given fixed time in the past, which is the time of recombination. So you don't have spatial information. But in any case, this has fluctuations in temperature, which depend on angle, and you can define delta T relative to the mean in the same way. And if the perturbations in the past were what we call adiabatic, which is basically that the perturbations in the matter track the perturbations in the radiation in this way. So the fact that matter scales as 1 over A cubed and the temperature of the CMB scales as T cubed leads you to guess that the fluctuations in the density of matter will scale with the temperature cubed. And if you use that, then you basically get the delta rho over rho. It goes like 3 delta T over T just from this cube up there. And it turns out that works out to be a pretty much true when you actually look at the data and analyze it. And the crucial point is that means that when we look out in the sky at the CMB, those temperature fluctuations that we're measuring are a direct measure of the density fluctuations at the time when the CMB decoupled from matter. And that's the time of recombination. So it's variously called recombination decoupling. And that surface out in, if we're here, so you can think of those photons coming towards you from some fixed surface out in the past, where the distance, that sphere is defined by the total distance, d, that light can travel from the time of recombination, which was about 300,000 years after the Big Bang, to today. So that sphere defines what's called the surface of last scattering. That's the same as saying, when something decouples, it means it no longer interacts with other particles, so it no longer scatters. You can tell I did a lot last time because I've gone onto three boards. The density fluctuations turn out to be, it's useful generally to analyze them in Fourier space. So K here is the, X is the co-moving position. So in a space-time metric, I've always used the notation that X is co-moving position. So the physical distance is the scale factor times the co-moving distance. And K is then called the co-moving wave number or co-moving momentum, just from the fact that momentum and wave number are the same thing, up to a factor of H bar. And when you analyze this in momentum space and you calculate the average of the square of the fluctuations, so that's the variance, essentially, of the distribution of fluctuations. It has some very special power spectra, which goes like 1 power of k. And understanding why that is true is what a lot of modern research is about, certainly research in the last 20 years or so. And so today, you had a question?
Delta K is not
dependent
on the space. How to average delta K square?
How do you do the average?
Yeah.
Well, so it depends what you're looking at. So if you're looking, that's quite a subtle point. Okay, so if you're looking at the actual distribution of galaxies, what you measure really is in real space. And so you measure this thing we called last time the correlation function, which was the average. So you take, let's just be naive and assume you can calculate the density in everywhere. Then the two-point correlation function is defined as the average of the product of the density at some point x plus r and the density at point x. Okay. But if the universe is homogeneous, then this two-point function should only depend on the difference between x plus r and x, so it shouldn't depend on x. Now, basically, when you do the measurements out in the sky, what you do is you look over here and here, and you count you've got a galaxy, two galaxies at some distance r apart, okay?
and you calculate the product of their densities at that point. And then you find somewhere over here another two galaxies which are the same distance apart. Okay, and then somewhere over here and so on and so on. And the average you're doing is just the summing of all those measurements. So you take all the different pairs of galaxies you can find that are the same distance apart, and you sum all over those, and that's the average you're doing in practice. But that average, I'll get to a bit later about actually what we calculate, which is a different thing. But that's a good question. Okay, so in this final lecture, we're going to concentrate on the question, where do these fluctuations come from? Okay, so it could just be they're put there by initial conditions, and that's only a possibility, and you couldn't argue too much against that fact. But it would be incredibly special initial conditions. So the spectrum of these fluctuations have very definite properties, very special properties, that would just be an amazing coincidence if you just started out with a completely random universe with random initial conditions. The chances of the universe actually looking, having such a perfectly power law spectrum as it does at large wavelengths, are just completely negligible. So we don't think that's a serious possibility. And also, there are now many good physical mechanisms that can give rise to something like this, and the main contender is something called inflation. Although there are alternatives. I worked on some of those alternatives, but inflation by far works out the best. So the basic question that we're often asking is like, so why do these fluctuations have the specific power law behavior they do? In other words, why does the power spectrum look like it does? Why do they have other properties such that, to a good approximation, they're adiabatic? And that means various different things, but the fact that they're adiabatic means is this relationship holds true. It doesn't have to be true fundamentally. So understanding why that is true is something that people work on. And there's another property which they're Gaussian, to a good approximation. And so Gaussian just means that if you have a random variable x, then the statement that the distribution of that is Gaussian is just that the probability of a particular value of x goes like a Gaussian. So this is the same as saying it's got a normal distribution. We would tend not to use that term. That's okay for one variable. In the context of density perturbations, you've really got an infinity of variables because you've got what the density fluctuation is at a given wave number, or what the density fluctuation is at a given position. But if you just concentrate on one wave number, it's still true that the probability of a given density fluctuation is Gaussian, to a good approximation, with the variance sigma squared here being that quantity we calculated over there, which is it's often called P of K, which is the power spectrum. So it's just this quantity here. I think last time I called it squiggle of K, but P of K is more common in practice. And also they have the property that different, along with this statement, is the fact that two different modes with different momenta, K1 and K2, are uncorrelated. So if you take the average of two density fluctuations with different momenta, they're uncorrelated. So, okay, you don't need to worry too much about that, but these are things we need to, that people are working on and trying to understand. Now, the most crucial problem with understanding where the density fluctuations in the universe come from, and why, for a long time, people couldn't see how to do it, develop good mechanisms, is something called the horizon problem. And so the horizon problem, as we discussed in earlier lectures, if the universe has a finite age, then there is a finite observable size of the universe, but in any given time, there's a finite distance that light could travel, and because nothing can travel faster than light, no information, no causal propagation can travel faster than light, then there's a finite size of the universe, which is called the particle horizon. Okay? At a given time, the natural size of that horizon depends on time, and pretty much it increases for a given equation of state. It looks like that. But basically, it usually increases roughly linearly in time. So at a given time in the universe, the horizon size is given by the age of the universe at that time. So today, the universe is 13.7 billion years old. So roughly speaking, the horizon, particle horizon size would be about 13 billion light years. Now, the problem is, the horizon problem is the following problem, that we know, say, the distance between two galaxies, according to Hubble's law, the distance between two galaxies scales with the scale factor. Okay? That's basically what you get from integrating that the velocity is proportional to the distance. So as the universe expands, galaxies move apart. That's what we really mean by expansion. And let's consider the case where the universe is just matter-dominated, as it has been in the last, most of the history of the universe, except today, in the very early universe, the universe was matter-dominated. So that corresponds to having an equation of state zero, W zero. So then, in that case, the scale factor goes like t to the 2/3 in time. So the problem is this, that this thing, the horizon size, scales linearly in time. Okay. So if we plot that out, obviously not to scale, then this is the horizon at a given time. This is supposed to be proportional to t. But the distance between two galaxies scales, let me call it dg, distance between galaxies, scales only as t to the 2/3, which is a smaller power than t. So it scales less rapidly. So that means if you take two galaxies today, of some distance d away, and you track back in time how far they were away at some earlier epoch in the evolution of the universe, then you always get this problem that if you go back far enough, then two galaxies that we see today will be eventually farther apart than the horizon size at that earlier time. Okay? So it's the physical horizon size is smaller. At earlier times decreases more rapidly than the distance between the galaxies. So although space is expanding, it doesn't actually expand as quickly as the horizon expands. And that's a serious problem, because it means this line essentially determines the line of causality. So it says that anything below is in causal contact. Okay, so that means they can interact with each other because things traveling less than the speed of light can give interactions. Yeah.
What does that say? Vector v equals h.
D. That's just the Hubble law.
Oh, that's just a d.
Yeah.
the vector.
I probably called it R before, whatever. It's just a vector. I'm just saying what Hubble's law is.
Okay. Yeah.
So this is a vector equation as well. And suddenly all this story, so I just talked about galaxies, but the same is true also for the cosmic microwave background. So the physical wavelength that we see today in the cosmic microwave background, those wavelengths are of order fractions of a meter because it's microwave, so it's like, well, I guess it's millimeters. What is microwave? It's whatever it is anyway, some small fraction of meters. And that will scale, that also scales with the scale factor in terms of the co-moving wavelength. Okay? So if you track back the physical wavelengths of the CMB that we see today, or any other photons, and you go to earlier times, then this will only go as t to the power of 2/3, at least in the matter-dominated era. And if you do this for radiation-dominated era, it's a similar story is true. It's only t to the half instead of t to the 2/3, but the point is that power is still less than 1. And so this is a serious problem if you think about the CMB. Because what we see out today in the CMB, the point is that we see to a very good approximation that the universe is at large scales homogeneous and isotropic. And furthermore, we see that the CMB is to a very good approximation of some thermal blackbody spectrum. And because it's a thermal blackbody spectrum, it means that at some point, why things will be thermal with a given temperature is because they've interacted with each other. There's been interactions. As we discussed before, to have an equilibrium, to have a notion of fixed temperature, you have to have interactions. So the fact that the CMB is almost perfectly a blackbody spectrum, in other words, it was in equilibrium with a fixed temperature, with only very small fluctuations around that, means that there must have been some causal mechanism that caused the interactions that brought you into equilibrium. But that can't be the case if the modes in the CMB were outside of each other's causal horizon earlier in the universe. It simply can't be the case that they have the same temperature. So we can give an estimate of how bad that is, bad that situation is. So today, the current size of the observable universe is about 10 to the 26 meters. And so up to a distance scale of 10 to the 26 meters, to a good approximation, the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. So simply the fact that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic up to that scale implies that there must have been some kind of causal interactions that brought about that homogeneity or isotropy, unless you put it in as just some incredibly fine-tuned initial conditions, which doesn't seem to make a lot of physical sense, although it is, you know, a consistent solution. So if you track back in time, the distance that corresponds to at any given time is the scale factor at that time divided by the scale factor today, times 10 to the 26 meters. And we could also rewrite that as the temperature today for the CMB divided by the temperature at some earlier time. Okay. So let's sort of track back as far as we could conceivably imagine going, which is to the Planck time.
So is everybody familiar with what the Planck time, Planck length is, that kind of thing? Nodding, okay. So the Planck time, as I'm sure hopefully heard in the strings and quantum gravity talks, is the Planck length is the scale at which quantum gravity effects kick in. And that scale is about, 10 to the minus, some very small number, but 10 to the minus 35 meters. And similarly as a time, you can convert that to time using the speed of light, 3 times 10 to the 8, we divide by that, so that's about 10 to the minus 43 seconds. Okay, so that's sort of the earliest time in the history of the universe in which we can treat things without making use of quantum gravity. We can treat things with general relativity. We know from without a shadow of a doubt that general relativity breaks down there, but we really expect it to be true already at 10 to the minus 41 seconds, you know, 100 times the Planck time, we expect general relativity to be true. So it's general relativity works very well for almost all the history of the universe. Anyway, so this is the farthest back we could go. And the temperature at that time turns out to would have been about 10 to the 32 Kelvin. Okay, so you could call that, if you like, you could call that the Planck temperature. So if you calculate what the current, if you take the current observable universe, that this distance of 10 to the 26, and you take it all the way back, how big was it in the early universe? So you're just doing the inverting the expansion of the universe. So that the size of it would be the ratio of the temperature today, which is about 3, so we can neglect that, divided by 10 to the 32 times 10 to the 26. Okay, so that's about 10 to the minus 6 meters. So that's how big the universe we see today was at the Planck time. There's some assumptions made. So the crucial question to ask is how big was the horizon, the particle horizon at that time? So the particle horizon is always pretty much of order, if you assume only matter or radiation domination, it's of order the age of the universe, as we said before, at that time. So it goes like C times T. And the age of the universe, well, this is just the Planck length. So at the Planck time, the typical size of the particle horizon would have been the Planck length, which is 10 to the minus 35 meters. Okay? So although this is a small number, it's massive in comparison to the size of the causally allowed, causally connected regions. So this is about, 10 to the 29, something like that. So this is another way of stating the horizon problem. So distances that we see today that have about the same temperature are similarly isotropic, similarly and homogeneous. They would have been massively far apart in terms of their particle horizon at earlier times by some very large factor, and this goes something like e to the 60, 65, roughly. Okay, so that's the horizon problem. So there's only one thing you can do. Well, you have to solve this problem in order to understand where the density fluctuations that seed the formation of galaxies come from. And so there's only one way to solve it. Well, there's two, actually. Well, they're all the same. So the only way to solve it is if at some point in the early, if this story changed. So this is the, let me try and do a better picture. So if this is the horizon that we see today, which basically increases with time, and this is the size of, say, the distance between two galaxies you want to look at. This comes back like this. Okay. There has to have been an earlier phase in the universe in which this one started, as you go backwards in time, this one starts decreasing less rapidly than this one, so that this one comes inside the causal horizon. Okay. So it usually looks something like that. So that picture was pretty bad. So there's some time in the past in which the reverse situation occurred. Okay, so if the universe is radiation or matter dominated, it's always true that the horizon size, the physical horizon size, grows more rapidly than the expansion of the universe. So that means, so we could just state that mathematically, that the horizon size divided by the scale factor is increasing. Okay, that's the situation out here. The quantity is increasing, the ratio of these two curves. So to solve the horizon problem, you have to have some epoch earlier in the universe in which the opposite was true, in which the size of the particle horizon relative to the expansion of the universe was decreasing. And so only that way will your two galaxies or your wavelength of the CMB come inside the particle horizon at time and be in causal contact. And this is just something you have to do. And then if the universe is expanding, which it is, although it could have been contracting at some earlier phase, but if we just take the standard view that it's just been expanding since the Big Bang, then there's only one way to do this. And that's basically because at any given time, the horizon size is of order 1 over h, the Hubble radius. So the Hubble constant, if you remember, is a rate, so it has dimensions of inverse time. So you can define the Hubble time to be h minus 1, which has dimensions of seconds. So that corresponds to a radius, the Hubble radius, which is c times h minus 1. But I'll always put c equals 1. So the horizon size at any given time is typically of order h to the minus 1. And h is, of course, dA dt 1 over a. So this ratio, dH over a, is given by the inverse of this. So you put this on the bottom, dA dt, and then scale factor on the bottom as well, times that. So it's basically 1 over dA dt. Did I do that right? Yeah. So the rate of change of that, rate of change of 1 over dA dt is the same as minus the double derivative of A divided by dA dt squared. And that has to be less than 0 to get this region where things switch over. And this thing being less than 0 is, of course, just the same as the double rate of change of the scale factor being bigger than 0. So since the scale factor measures the distances between galaxies, measures the expansion of the universe, its double rate of change is simply the acceleration of the universe at a given time. So this is the same as saying that the universe has to accelerate at some time in the past to solve the horizon problem. That's the only way, simply the only way to do it in an expanding universe. There's another way in a contracting universe, but we don't need to worry about that. So if you take the horizon problem seriously, and people do, we have to believe that at some point in the past, the universe was accelerating, rather than decelerating, which is what it would do during a completely matter-dominated era or a completely radiation-dominated era. And this period of acceleration in the past is called inflation. That's exactly what we mean by inflation. So, and that's just because if the universe is accelerating, the scale factors, if the double rate of change, d2a dt squared, is positive, that means that dA dt is increasing. So the velocity is getting bigger and bigger. So the And that means that in turn that the scale factor will get very rapidly bigger and bigger. And so the universe will start inflating in volume very, very, very rapidly. okay, and in fact, we already know that the current universe is also accelerating. So whenever you have, as we said before, that the current universe we believe to be dominated by something called dark energy, which makes up about 76% of the energy density we see today. And that has an equation of state W, which is very close to minus one. And the case exactly one is called a cosmological constant. And in fact, already, I think in about 1917, De Sitter considered precisely a universe with equation of state W exactly minus one. In other words, a cosmological constant. Einstein introduced it very soon after general relativity. And De Sitter found the solution, what that corresponded to. And that's pretty easy to do. So the Friedmann equation is just that in a flat universe. So if the equation of state W is minus one, that's the same as saying that the energy density, which in general scales like, what is it? 3, 1 plus W. No, that's not right. Sorry, minus 3, 1 plus W. Yeah. Okay. In general, the energy density for a particular equation of state W, which is P over rho, scales like A to the minus 3, 1 plus W. For W equals minus 1, then it scales as A to the 0. In other words, it's constant in time. And that's why it's called the cosmological constant. So it's some weird kind of energy density that as the universe expands, you expect the energy density to go down as you're expanding that, but somehow you're recreating energy within a given co-moving volume and the energy density remains constant. So if this quantity is constant, then the Hubble constant is also constant. So H is a constant in time. Okay? So if H is a constant, then H is 1 over A dA dt, which is some constant that I'll call H0, then this equation is easy to solve, and it just tells you that the scale factor is an exponential in time. Okay? So, and this, a geometry that does this, so that corresponds to a space-time geometry that looks like this. Just setting that to one. So a geometry does this, the volume is increasing exponentially with time, exponentially rapidly. So it doesn't take a lot of time for this quantity to increase by a massive amount. And that geometry is called the De Sitter space, named after its founder. And it's actually a very important, just mathematically, it's an important geometry because if you're into these things, it represents one of the maximally symmetric spacetimes. So it has the same amount of symmetry as Minkowski space, which is defined. And so if you're interested in group theory, then the symmetry is the special orthogonal group for one. Anyway, but you don't need to know about that. so that's a particular elegant example of a space-time whose volume increases exponentially, and so it accelerates. If you just work out a double dot for this solution, a double dot goes like H naught squared, A naught e to the H naught t, which is bigger than zero. So that's accelerating. But it's not the only example. It's just the most symmetric, the most special example, and also the first one that was found. So in general, when you construct an inflationary model, you want to emulate this idea of getting exponential expansion. So you want something that looks close to the Sitter space. Because during this period when you're exponentially expanding, that's precisely the period in which the curve in which the physical wavelength comes inside the causal horizon at a given time, and so you can come back into causal contact as you go backwards into the past. So in general, you need to construct some kind of new form of energy density or matter whose equation of state W is, turns out it has to be less than like minus a third to get expansion, but more generally, we want something which is close to minus one. So this is clearly some new form of energy density which has nothing to do with radiation, nothing to do with normal matter that we are familiar with. And in fact, for a long time, certainly until the 70s, people thought, you know, such things, they just don't make sense. They didn't think anything existed like that. There's some energy conditions, like known as the strong energy condition, that says, I can't remember these very well, but I think that W has to be bigger than zero. And the reason for that was that if anything whose equation of state W is the pressure divided by the density, so density always has to be positive because it's the energy density, and negative energy is a disaster. So physically, energy density is always positive. So anything that has equation of state W which is less than zero has to have negative pressure. And such a thing is pretty odd. We know of no, I think it's fair to say, we know of no example of something in nature which to this date we have measured to have negative pressure. I think that's true. And given that fact, people didn't believe anything with W less than zero made sense. But for two reasons. One, the current expansion, current acceleration of the universe, this dark energy period, forces you to have W less than zero and inflation as well, if you believe it. And 99% of people do. That also forces you to have W less than zero. It turns out theoretically not to be that difficult to find something that does do that. And the generic thing that does that is something called a scalar field. So is anybody familiar with what I mean by a scalar field? Okay, some of you, if you've done GR, then or probably you're familiar. So scalar field is just something. Probably even if you've done relative special relativity. Scalar field is just something that depends on space, time, and position. But the statement that it's a scalar means that it's not like a tensor, so it has no indices. And in particle physics language, that's the same as saying that it corresponds to something that has spin zero. Okay. So in fact, objects with spin zero, fundamental objects with spin zero, fundamental particles with spin zero, are not known so far. They've not been observed. So the electron has spin a half in units of h bar. And similarly, all the protons, neutrons, blah, 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 all have non-zero spin. So a scalar field, whilst a perfectly sensible notion for something which has spin zero, to this date, no one has detected anything with spin zero, fundamental particles with spin, zero. Although there is one clear candidate that people are hoping to see soon, which is called the Higgs boson, or the Higgs particle. And people are hoping to see this very soon in LHC, the Large Hadron Collider in CERN. The Higgs boson plays a crucial role in the Standard Model of Particle Physics. Without it, theoretically, it falls apart, but unfortunately, it's not been detected to this date. So if people don't see it in the LHC, and they see nothing else, then no one will ever fund particle physics experiments again, because people have been saying it should be there for years. Okay, so in fact, so the scalar field is actually a familiar concept in particle physics. So in identifying some function in space and time with a particle, what I'm essentially doing is using the idea of, using the basic quantum mechanical idea of sort of wave-particle duality. Which, in its more sophisticated form, is something that we call quantum field theory. And so that's the idea that that really, in modern terms, we would say that fundamentally, what things are, what electrons and stuff are really fields. Things like this, things that depend on space and time, but those fields are quantized because of quantum effects. And so when you try to measure that field, you find that all you ever really measure is sort of individual particles directly. But because fundamentally it's a field, it has wave-like properties as well. So in particular, a scalar field satisfies a wave equation, which is just a relativistic generalization of the Schrödinger equation using quantum mechanics. And in fact, this wave equation, Schrödinger wrote this wave equation down first before he wrote down the Schrödinger wave equation, and he couldn't make sense of it. So he put it in the bin. But it came back, but it was actually a perfectly sensible thing to do. So this wave equation, to make clear, the standard way you can sort of think about where the Schrödinger wave equation comes from is you take the energy in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. You say the energy is the momentum squared divided by 2 times the mass. And then quantum mechanics tells you, so what Schrödinger guessed is that the energy should be replaced with some differential operator plus, and the momentum with a similar differential operator. Oh, and generally, of course, you can have some potential, which is a function of position. The momentum replaced by some differential operator, and so you get the Schrödinger wave equation by applying these differential operators on some function. So before Schrödinger did this, he did it in the relativistic case because, I mean, people knew about special relativity at that time. And in the relativistic case, the energy is related to momentum according to that formula, okay? So this is E equals mc squared, but included, but when this is the rest mass, so when things are moving, then you also have this additional contribution. So you're just applying the same trick to the Schrödinger did, replacing this thing with IH bar d by dt squared, and this thing by I minus IH bar grad squared, and setting C to 1, and H bar to 1, and applying on some field phi, this gives you this equation. So this is essentially the relativistic Schrödinger equation. And it was also discovered somewhat afterwards by Klein-Gordon, and so it gets the name Klein-Gordon equation because they actually published it. And today, Schrödinger couldn't make sense of this, but today we understand what it means. It's just the wave equation of a spin-zero particle, and Schrödinger was trying to describe electrons, and so that wasn't the right thing to do there, which is why he had to give up and go to non-relativistic things and wait for Dirac to figure out how to write down the wave equation for an electron. Anyway, so these things are perfectly sensible physical ideas, just some scalar field. Now, if you're in an expanding universe, this wave equation gets slightly modified. And I won't explain why it gets modified like this, but you can just trust me. So this is the equation that describes a field which corresponds to a massive particle in an expanding space with Hubble constant h. In this term, just as it did in the last lecture for the density perturbations, this looks like a friction or damping term. Except there the factor was 2, whereas here it's 3. And that's just some minor subtlety. But okay, so it gives rise to the same effect of Hubble damping. So damping tends to slow down the motion. So it's just like if you have a harmonic oscillator, it's damped. Instead of oscillating rapidly, if it's damped, then you lose energy, so it tends to slow down those oscillations. So another way of saying it is, if the universe expands, energy is not conserved because of the expansion of the universe, and this is the term that corresponds to that fact. Okay. So this thing, the particle that this corresponds to, is something we call the inflaton, because it's this particle that's going to drive inflation. Okay, so just within the naming spirit that everything, a particle ends with on, like an electron, we call it the inflaton. So how does this give rise to inflation? Okay. So, to see that, let's first just throw away this term. So we look for completely homogeneous and isotropic solutions. So that's the same as saying we're going to assume that our scalar field is just a function of time and not of space. So when that's true, we can just set this term to 0. And we get what I can replace this with proper derivatives. And so now it really looks like, this equation really looks like a damped harmonic oscillator. Where you would normally write down something harmonic oscillator described by some position x would satisfy some equation like this. Okay, you're probably familiar with this kind of thing. So gamma here is 3h and omega squared is m squared. And so because of that, we can think, knowing what harmonic oscillators do, we can understand the dynamics of this field. So the potential energy of a harmonic oscillator just goes like half omega squared, which in this case is m squared, x squared, so in which case is phi squared. So that's the potential energy. So if you didn't have the damping term and you set the thing off over here, it would just oscillate back and forth with fixed amplitude. Okay? But because of the damping term, then the oscillator tends to lose energy, so when it goes over here, it doesn't get quite as far, and so on, and loses energy over time. Now, to get for this field to act to drive inflation, it needs not just to be damped, but overdamped. So that means that the damping force is so strong, it doesn't even get to do one oscillation. The field just comes down here, and this damping term, you're losing energy so rapidly from the damping term that you just very slowly evolve down here. Okay? So that's, if you take that equation and you take this, the damping term here to be really very large and you solve it, then that's what you'll find will happen. So you're really, really very slowly roll down. And when that occurs, that's something called slow roll inflation. And so the physical condition that required for that to occur is that the the time scale of the expansion, h, which determines the damping term, has to be much, much bigger than the time scale of the oscillations, which is set by the mass. So in the language, in the harmonic oscillator language, that's the same as saying gamma has to be much bigger than omega. Okay, that's when the system is overdamped. When that is true, then you can essentially throw away this term, which comes from the oscillations, and replace the equation with a simple first-order differential equation for the field, which looks like that. Okay. So how does this drive inflation? So the point is that if you have this scalar field out there in space, you can think of it as a coherent distribution of particles of these inflaton quanta. And each of those particles will have some energy. So this scalar field will have some physical energy density, rho, which is given by a half phi dot squared plus, so this is the kinetic term, plus a half grad phi squared, so this is called the gradient energy, and some potential energy V. So this is the same as saying for harmonic oscillator, the energy of a harmonic oscillator is just a half, yeah. It's kinetic energy plus its potential energy, okay? So that's the same thing. So the scalar field acts like a harmonic oscillator. It has some additional energy from the gradient terms, but for these homogeneous solutions, we can neglect that. We can neglect those terms. What happens in this slow roll limit, when the damping term is very large, it's also the same as saying that the kinetic energy is much, much smaller than the potential energy. In other words, not only can we throw this term away because we're looking at homogeneous solutions, we can also throw this term away. Okay. So that means that the potential energy, which is for this particular example is a half m squared phi squared, completely dominates the energy density of this scalar field, of this inflaton scalar field. And so so the Freeman equation tells you that because of this energy density V, then the space will expand. Now, if you remember before that to get the de Sitter solution, the special case of accelerating the expansion, we got it with rho being a constant in time. So that tells us that physically, whenever the potential, if these conditions are met, if the potential V of phi doesn't change very rapidly with time, so V, which you can measure by something like, if you look at the rate of change of the velocity of the potential over Hubble time, something like that, if that's much less than one, then this scalar field will act like something whose energy density is approximately constant. It won't be exactly constant, but it'll be approximately constant because if the system is very highly overdamped, it rolls down very slowly, which is the same as saying that the physical value of the scalar field, which is this position here, changes very, very slowly with time. So that's what we mean by slow roll inflation. And so whenever that is true, if the potential changes with the, if the potential is just a function of the scalar field, and if that changes with time very slowly, then you will be very close to a de Sitter solution. Not exactly, but sufficiently close that the universe will be inflating. Okay, so we can just work that out a bit more explicitly for this particular case. So in this limit, you just got a first order differential equation, 3h phi dt plus m squared phi equals 0. And the Hubble constant in this approximation, we assume it's completely dominated by the potential energy, which is itself a half m squared phi squared. So that's 4 pi g over 3 m squared phi squared. So that's the same as saying that the Hubble constant can essentially be thought of as a function of the scalar field. Okay, and it's linear in the scalar field. And so then you can plug that into this equation. Just plug that into this equation, you get something like 3 root 4 pi g over 3 m phi d phi dt plus m squared phi equals 0. Phi's cancel, and m cancels one here and here. So d phi dt, well, should be pretty obvious that the solution goes like m over square root 12 pi g times t. Okay? So the scalar field evolves linearly in time. But the field is changing with time. And so physically what will happen is that the field will be rolling down the potential. But if the coefficient of this term is very small, which it will be in order to satisfy these conditions, so that phi dot squared is much less than v, then in fact this is small in comparison to the constant term. So that's the same as saying that to a good approximation, the field is at some constant position. And because it's at some constant position, the potential is approximately constant. And so then you'll be approximately de Sitter, and the space-time will be inflating. All right. Okay, so inflation is necessary to solve the horizon problem. And it also solves a few other problems, which I won't go into here, such as the flatness problem and monopole problem. So the flatness problem is, why is the universe spatially so flat? So that up to now I've been assuming that the topology of the universe is flat, but it could be closed or it could be open. But observations tell us that to a very good approximation it is flat. And inflation, because it provides this exponential expansion, it also, if you take something that's curved, like if you take a sphere and you expand it incredibly, then any small region on a sphere will look approximately flat. And so inflation provides a natural explanation of the flatness problem. And also solves something called the monopole problem. And monopoles are, a monopole is a magnetically charged particle. So normally we're used to particles having electric charge, but we never give them magnetic charge. We give them magnetic dipoles or magnetic quadrupoles, but we never give them an actual direct magnetic charge. And a monopole is something like this. And the fact is we've never observed one of these things in nature. But theories like grand unified theories predict the existence of monopoles. Too many that we would have expected to have observed some today. But inflation sort of wipes away this problem, because the energy density of monopole, if the monopoles are produced before inflation, the energy density, of course, like all matter, scales like 1 over a cubed. So if you have some finite density of monopoles before inflation, and the universe expands exponentially, this will decrease exponentially in size, and you will be left with only a very negligible fraction of monopoles relative to the energy density of the inflaton. Okay. In fact, it was really that problem. Inflation was discovered because Alan Guth, who was one of the inventors at least, was more worried about the monopole problem specifically than the horizon problem. But he put together after the fact that inflation also described the horizon problem. But inflation survived as a theory for the last 25 years, not because of this, not really because of these problems, monopoles. I don't care about the monopole problem particularly. But the real reason it survived was not only that it's solved the horizon problem, because it provided a natural explanation for where those little density fluctuations came from. So what we call delta rho over rho, and the fluctuations in the CMB, whose amplitude are about 10 to the minus 4 or 10 to the minus 5. Inflation gives a natural explanation of those things. And that's and the explanation is quite remarkable, because the point is, if you have a scalar field, so this scalar field phi physically corresponds to what we might call a coherent state of inflaton particles. Okay. So quantum field theory tells us that this scalar field is really corresponds to how you would describe some spin zero, some massive spin zero particles. And quantum mechanics tells us, so up to now we've been just thinking that we've just been taking a solution which made perfect sense at the classical level, that the scalar field was just a function of time and completely independent of space. And that's a consistent solution classically, but it's not consistent quantum mechanically because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Okay, so, or which is one way of looking at it. So, very qualitatively speaking, Heisenberg uncertainty principle says that nothing is ever really exactly at rest, or if it is at rest, then you don't know where it is. So there is always quantum fluctuations. Particles always naturally have quantum fluctuations that have some non-zero energy. Okay. So similarly, this at the level of fields, that's the statement that this you can never just have a solution like that. The solution always, on top of it, has little quantum fluctuations, delta phi, which are going to depend on space and time. And those are forced to exist because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, or just because of quantum physics, however you want to look at it. And these fluctuations, which you're forced to have, have a particular characteristic spectrum, and it's very simple to work out what that spectrum is. So if you think, so I told you that the energy density of the inflaton, so the energy density of inflaton goes like phi dot squared plus a half grad phi squared. So if it's just a massive field, it looks like that. So if you expand around some homogeneous solution, and you have some quantum fluctuations, then these give a contribution to there is a quantum contribution to the energy density, which will come from these quantum fluctuations. And roughly speaking, you'll get a term like this when you expand out plus other junk. But looking at this term is going to be enough to see what the answer is. So this is the energy density in position space. But you could also work out this in momentum space. So if you calculate the total energy, in some given co-moving volume, it's something like that, just taking the energy density multiplying by the volume. And then because of some, whatever it's called, Parzival's theorem or whatever, if we go into momentum space, this is the same as saying you integrate over three momenta of the fluctuations written in momentum space, where phi dot will be the same as saying delta phi squared times the frequency squared. So we're assuming that each mode goes like, oscillates like this. Okay. And this is a good approximation when those inflaton, when the wavelength of the inflaton is smaller than the horizon size during inflation. So what happens in the process of inflation is as we said earlier, inflation is a process by which physical length scales, which scale like the scale factor, get stretched faster than the horizon expands. And in fact, the horizon during inflation is pretty much constant. For perfect de Sitter, it's constant. So this is the physical horizon size. So the expansion of the universe during inflation takes a given wavelength, which might be like look like that, oscillating and have this form and this energy density, and it stretches that wavelength until it's eventually bigger than the horizon size. And when it is, it stops. It instead of oscillating outside, it just goes to a constant, being very naively speak. So this, over the course of time, as the universe inflates, this very short wavelength mode will get stretched, longer wavelength until it goes outside the horizon. And this is how you solve the horizon problem, because those fluctuations are outside the horizon. And then when you go into the radiation and matter-dominated eras, they come back in again. And the fact that they were once within causal contact with each other within the horizon is how you solve the horizon problem. So what did I want to say? So the point is, that's right. So if you have this field oscillating like this, corresponds to this physically what this corresponds to is saying the inflaton field is made up of lots of particles, each of which whose energy is h bar omega. So if you think of this as a distribution of particles, then you would have expected that the total energy would have been something like the integral of h bar omega times the number density, the number of particles. Now, if I neglect the mass of the inflaton, so instead of, which is a good approximation actually, so that the dispersion relation E squared is P squared plus M squared just becomes E squared is P squared, which is the same as saying omega is the modulus of K. So that's the same as saying that the waves propagate at the speed of light, which is actually a good approximation. Anything that's massless propagates at the speed of light. Then comparing this with this fixes the amplitude of the fluctuations, delta K, to go like 1 over square root of K. So these quantum fluctuations scale like 1 over square root of K, and then they oscillate when they're within the horizon, roughly speaking. Now, this is a sort of long story that I'm not going to go into too much, but the point is that basic quantum mechanics fixes the wave number dependence of these fluctuations. Okay, so it fixes the power spectrum, which is the average of delta phi k squared. So you might already naively think that the power spectrum of these inflaton fluctuations goes like 1 over k. And that's not the right answer, because this is only how the fluctuations look when they're well within the horizon. And they also depend on the scale factor like that. When they get stretched, and they get pushed outside the horizon, then the mode stops oscillating. So just as for the genes instability, the short wavelength modes were oscillating and the long wavelength ones weren't stable, for the inflationary perturbations, what happens is that when they go outside the horizon, which is the same as saying that their wave number gets to be bigger than A times H, then delta phi k goes like a sum of the growing mode, or actually a constant mode, but we call it growing mode because of this, the terminology we had before, plus some decaying mode, which I can't remember how it goes, but probably decays exponentially or something like that. But some mode that you can neglect because it's decaying away. And when you solve this the differential equation describing these fluctuations, you essentially match the small-scale fluctuations, the sub-horizon fluctuations, with the super-horizon fluctuations at the point where k equals ah, which we can also write as a is k over h. And so that fixes the spectrum, delta phi k, to go like 1 over k to the 3 halves. So you don't need to worry too much about the details of that, other than to say that quantum fluctuations have a given fixed characteristic spectrum, okay, which goes like this. And so the physical power spectrum of these density fluctuations goes like 1 over k cubed. Okay, so the variance of those fluctuations goes like 1 over k cubed. Whenever that occurs, we call that spectrum scale invariant. And the reason is, if you go back to position space, what the power spectrum is the average, is the Fourier transform of the two-point function for the scalar field. Okay, so it's something like integral d3k times this quantity, delta phi k squared e to the I k dot r. So if this quantity goes like 1 over k cubed, you're then integrating that with respect to 3 powers of k. So overall, the k factors cancel. Okay, so you've got 1 over k cubed here, and you've got k cubed here. And so that's called scale invariant, because if you neglect this term, then if you rescale the wave number k by some multiple, because it's 1 over k cubed here, and you're integrating with vector 3k there, then this factor cancels out. So the it's independent of that rescaling. So that's a very special type of spectrum, which inflation predicts very naturally. More generally, it's not quite 3 exactly. It's some number very close to 3. And that what that number is something that you can measure within the CMB. Okay, and so the end of the story is that these quantum fluctuations are generated during inflation. Eventually they decay. We don't see this inflaton today. Where has it gone to? What happens is that the inflaton eventually decays into matter and radiation. In other words, the standard model particles that make us up, electrons and leptons, baryons, those kinds of things. So all the energy that exists, the energy density at the end of inflation, the energy density that's in the inflaton gets converted into the energy density of radiation. And then you start the standard radiation-dominated phase of the hot Big Bang era. And so because of all that energy density of the inflaton gets converted into radiation, also the fluctuations in that energy density get converted into the fluctuations of the radiation's energy density. So the fact that there are fluctuations is the same as saying that the energy density of the inflaton here is different than is here. And so because the decay process is local, that also means that the fluctuations, when the inflaton gets converted into radiation, the energy density of radiation here is different than it is over here. And these, the fluctuations in the inflaton's energy density are directly proportional to the fluctuations in the inflaton itself. And those are what have this characteristic 1 over k cubed power spectrum. So what happens is that the inflaton decays into radiation, and that radiation during through a process which is called reheating. And it's called reheating because at the end of inflation, the universe is incredibly cold. But when the inflaton decays all its energy into radiation, that radiation has a lot of energy density, which will very quickly thermalize at some very high temperature. So the temperature of the universe during inflation goes down exponentially, and then suddenly it jumps up. Okay, and then it cools much more slowly from then on. So that's the phase of reheating. This is inflation. And then the period after is what is usually called just the hot beginning of the hot Big Bang cosmology. So it's called that because before inflation, people just referred to this picture as the hot Big Bang model. So those quantum fluctuations, inflaton fluctuations, get converted into fluctuations in radiation, which in turn decays, or either decays into matter or just becomes matter at some later stage. And so becomes exactly the thing that we call delta M, which is or delta matter, which is the fluctuations in the density of matter that eventually seed the formation of galaxies. And similarly, because the two are related, these quantum fluctuations are precisely the same as what seed the fluctuations in the temperature of the CMB that we see today. So what we perceive today as classical fluctuations, according to the inflationary paradigm, started out as quantum fluctuations, very, very small amplitude quantum fluctuations that you just have to have there, that get stretched outside of the horizon by some massive amount, 60 e-folds worth. So e-folds, I didn't talk about e-folds, but that means that the scale factor, we believe that at least during inflation, the scale factor of the universe increased by a factor about e to the 60. So the volume of the universe increased by the cube of that. Those modes get stretched massively far outside the horizon. Then you have reheating, and then the universe just goes through the hot Big Bang region, which is where it's radiation dominated, and then matter dominated, and then eventually dark energy dominated, and that's what we see today. And those little quantum fluctuations grow and grow and grow by the gravitational instability that we discussed last time, and that's what we perceive in the galaxy distribution today. And this very characteristic spectrum, the scale invariant spectrum 1 over k cubed, if you work out what you expect to see today, the spectrum of galaxies that we see, it exactly fits with that initial prediction, which gives very, very strong evidence for inflation, for inflationary models. And at this point, we don't really know if there are no serious contenders to this idea of what gives rise to the origin of structure in the universe. Okay, so that's it. Any questions?